This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting. We're here with H.K. Roy, who was a staff officer with the CIA for 13 years and then consulted from the outside afterwards. Hi, H.K., how are you?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. As you know, the reason I asked you to come in was dealing with Afghanistan and the reality today. I mean, this morning before you came in, you were in the truck trying to get some people out of Afghanistan on the phone.
You know, it seems like even though you leave the government, you're never really out. And so I've been trying to help broker introductions between people who need to get out and people who can get them out. And there are, you know, as you can imagine, there are the official channels, which are still going to be operational at least until next Tuesday. But then there are lots of veterans and former intelligence and other people who are informally, in an unofficial way, trying to do their best to get people out as well.
Let's say you're an Afghani and you're on the outskirts of Kabul. What happens going forward? How would you get out?
Well, that's the thing. It kind of depends on who you are and what your status is. But Taliban have said right now no more Afghans can come out.
And why is that? Why is their position so hardline like that?
You know, they've always been very hardline. In fact, they've been almost pretending that they're not as hardline at the moment. But we'll see what happens. We'll see their true colors again, I think, in another week, if not less. You know, they don't want the brain drain to happen because they need people to, you know, the technocrats to run the country, because they are now inheriting a country which they have to run. And they're going to find it's very difficult. And then part of it is they want to track down and kill those who collaborated with the U.S. military and intelligence services for the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll see that unfold in a big way starting next Tuesday.
Right now, say you were an interpreter and you're trying to get out. How do you physically do that in the short?
If they're lucky enough to get through the checkpoints and get to the airport and they have the right paperwork, they can prove who they are and all that, they can get out. And that's part of the problem. A lot of these interpreters and others are spread out all over the country and cannot get to Kabul. And so they're basically stuck inside. And I'm guessing that a majority of those we need to get out will not get out. And then a lot of others have been drawn to Kabul in order to try and get out, and now they won't be able to. So they're going to be kind of in a fishbowl. It'll be easier for the Taliban to hunt them down and execute them.
Going forward, how would you physically get out? It would be cross-country, wouldn't it?
That's the thing, though. There will be all, after Tuesday's deadline, the 31st, when the U.S. troops presumably all leave and the airport shuts down, they're going to have to figure out different ways to get out. I'm sure certain, you know, Americans will continue to help. They can maybe get into other countries, you know, neighboring countries. Some borders the Taliban probably don't control very well. There are all kinds of ways to get people out of a country. But this mad scramble for the airport right now is going to come to an end. And hopefully it won't be too ugly of an end.
How did we get into this position?
I mean, there's sort of the big picture, the macro strategic view, and then there's the micro view and the tactical short-term screw-ups. You know, we've been there for 20 years, and it's very frustrating that almost 20 years to the day after 9/11, when the Taliban controlled Afghanistan, we signed a surrender agreement with them, and we're leaving, and they're going to control the country again. And that's kind of that's hard to see, but on the other hand, if you look at the big picture, as we were discussing earlier, for centuries, anybody who's tried to conquer and control Afghanistan, found out the hard way it's just not possible.
The British twice.
Mm-hmm. The Soviets, the Russians, and now us. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, big picture, getting out is what the American people want. You know, both mm-hmm. Trump and Biden seem to reflect that the will of the American people. So maybe getting out is the right thing to do, you know, mm-hmm. big picture. Although there are lots of people in the government, the military, who say, look, with a minimal investment, 2,500 troops is minimal cost. They were not, for the most part, not in a combat mode. So minimal to no casualties, we were able to keep the lid on things. So why not continue doing that? And that's a very compelling argument. On the other hand, because of the, you know, what I call the surrender agreement that Pompeo and Trump made with the Taliban, this is kind of bound to happen. What, you know, once they did that, without even including the our partner, the Afghan government, who is as corrupt as any government on the planet. So it's, you know, they're our partner, but they're corrupt. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the U.S. government negotiated with the enemy. This is the mutual enemy of America and the Afghan government for the past 20 years. We negotiated directly with the enemy, made a deal, cut out our Afghan government partner, and insisted on the release of 5,000 extremely dangerous Taliban prisoners. Once that happened, the writing was on the wall for the Afghan government, and they immediately began to sort of cut deals with the Taliban throughout the country because they knew they no longer had American support. So this train was already in motion. Now, Biden's been president for, what, 7-8 months, and so he had plenty of time to do things the right way. And so he owns this current catastrophe completely. You know, a lot of people have been saying for many months, we need to get people out of there, mm-hmm. and nothing happened.
The tragedy, though, is an inherited disaster.
It's inherited, but again, he is president, and yeah. he's had a chance to do things the right way and plan and prepare and get people out, and he didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And I've really been kind of disappointed and frustrated.
Part of it is just overwhelmed, and only so many hours in the day.
I don't think so. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the government is big and we can, you know, mm-hmm. walk and chew gum at the same time. There's no greater military on the planet. They have ways to plan and exfiltrate people. I think he just, you know, like a lot of politicians, he's stubborn and he wants to stick to his guns. And again, big picture, he's probably right. Maybe mm-hmm. we should get out, mm-hmm. but he's handling this the wrong way. And the other thing that disappoints me is, you know, Trump was someone who almost openly wanted to destroy NATO and our alliances, didn't mm-hmm. care about our allies. Well, I figured, you know, Biden will be different. He's, you know, he's been around for a long time. He's intelligent. And mm-hmm. it's been disappointing to see that he also has essentially ignored our allies and undermined those who have been helping us in Afghanistan for the past 20 years as mm-hmm. well. I mean, it's just, it's exactly what you would expect from Trump. And now, and Biden is doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's just very frustrating to see the way this has been carried out, because a lot of people will die.
Yeah. The bigger picture, kind of a reset. I know my acquaintance, the 4-star general, 33rd commandant of the Marine Corps, Michael Hagee, he had told me a long time ago, he said, we should not be in the business of nation building.
Right.
The military.
Right. And, you know, that's the thing, big picture. Maybe we should have gotten out of Afghanistan after we got in for the right reasons, right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to do that, and it was for the right reasons, and we had some success. We obviously didn't get bin Laden until 2011. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we could make the argument that we should have gotten out in 2002 or 3.
Right.
We certainly should not have invaded Iraq, but that's a whole other story.
Well, 2002, 2003, that's when we kind of pulled back and shifted our power efforts to Iraq.
Exactly.
And if we had just stayed there with that momentum, right. the outcome could have been very different.
It could have. And that's part. So I'm... Even though I have been working in Iraq for the past 18 years, I think the invasion was a huge mistake. They did not threaten our mm-hmm. national security. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq until after we invaded. We could go on and on about
right,
that.
Right.
But we definitely took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan by diverting our attention to Iraq unnecessarily and expensively. On the other hand, it's Afghanistan. So maybe even if we had not invaded Iraq, the outcome would still be the same in Afghanistan,
right.
just because it's such you know, an impossible place.
When again, going back to the mid-1800s, the British, clear and present, just got their butts kicked.
Right.
And their warning to all future was, don't even try.
Right. And we kind of knew that after the Soviet experiment in Afghanistan failed, and which we gloated over, and that contributed to them losing the Cold War. And so, we knew better in a sense.
And part of it is trying to inject our ways of living on a very different culture.
Right.
It's like we talked about in Iraq, my friend that did the white paper, he said, this is a warlord-driven country.
Yeah.
It's not a country that has a city council and mayoral races, but that's what Brenner tried to do in Iraq.
Yeah, it's very tribal. But
that's even more so in Afghanistan, correct?
Right, right. In fact, even the Taliban, and again, I'm not an expert on the Taliban, but I think they're broken up into multiple tribes as well. And so I expect to see lots of infighting just within Afghanistan in the, you know, in the coming months and years.
And another thing we talked about earlier has to do the last 20 years in Afghanistan. The young generation has got a taste of a very different culture and world. So where are they going to go with what they've had a taste of?
Right. That's the thing. This is going to be difficult to watch because this is a whole generation that's grown up on, you know, under relative freedom compared to what they experienced before. And, you know, people are more educated. Certainly girls and women are educated. And there's been a sense of freedom that we did bring to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And they're not just going to stand by and accept the old school Taliban rule. And of course, Taliban are saying, "Oh, you know, we're the kinder, gentler Taliban light now." But that remains to be seen.
Going forward, just envisioning, how do you think that the young generation are going to proceed?
That's hard to say. You know, I've seen that happen in Iraq as well. It's sort of the same thing. I was there just before the pandemic, and was kind of blown away by how much Baghdad had been transformed. For the first time, I didn't feel threatened at all. There were modern shopping malls and car dealerships and, you know, young people dressed like Westerners, you know, guys with spiky hair and and girls dressed much less modestly than they used to. And so, you know, once you, and of course everybody has a cell phone and is connected to the internet. So once you let that genie out of the bottle, it's tough to put it back in. Now in Afghanistan, again, the Taliban are just medieval thugs, and they don't tolerate dissent. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. You know, there are still some pockets of resistance around Afghanistan, military resistance.
Do you think there will be a developing underground and insurgents doing strategic attacks? And
I would think so. And again, I'm not an expert on Afghanistan, but there are, you know, tribes. I think the son of Massoud is still resisting in the north. And so, and again, just the people generally are not going to accept the old ways. But again, you look at Iran, and it's kind of a similar situation with the religious fanatics take over. And they've done a good job of keeping their population under control. You know, there's been uprisings, but they don't last long. And so,
what's really interesting about Iran, the people I know, Iranians from the university and whatnot, it's such an intellectual, such an evolved culture and society that there's even a huger disconnect between that prehistoric and modern.
Yeah, it's tough to see. And again, there's only so much, as we found the hard way, there's only so much we can do to influence events. You know, there are limits to American power. And we seem to have to learn that the hard way over and over again.
Going forward, and actually going back the 60s, Kennedy and whatnot, USAID had a much stronger presence on the world stage. We know it was twofold, but there was an element of a greater good, of helping other countries.
Right. Yeah, you know, it'd be nice to see that again. In fact, even in the Middle East, you know, the Brits and the French were colonial powers, but the Americans went in sometimes as missionaries without much luck, but they went in to build schools, you know, in Beirut, the American University of Beirut, and to educate people and do good things without expecting anything in return. And that's a great way to project our power and our influence, and it's very, very effective. fact, that's one thing I've always thought we need in this country, again, especially with the tribalism that's taking place right now, the divisions in our own country, which I'm very pessimistic about, have some sort of mandatory service requirement for people, for kids when they turn 18.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the military.
Right.
Military is one option.
Yeah, I've had this, I had a discussion with Michael Hagee about that.
Uh-huh.
I said, dude, even if a guy is anti-war, they can still serve. They can serve in the VA or medical
setting. Or in the Forest Service.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's a great equalizer when everybody has to go out there and do something for your country.
Yeah.
Whether it's military or not.
Doesn't Germany do something like that?
I think a lot of countries do that, you know. And I really think that would help our own internal problems a lot to have that kind of shared experience among all Americans.
Because, yeah, and building some pride along the way.
Right, and doing something good. And, you know, we're just such a divided country right now.
Yeah. You were in Iraq not too long ago. You said you went last time just pre-COVID. So that was kind of your deal breaker on going over.
Because the things were pretty bad in Iraq and still are with COVID. Despite all the progress that has been made there, you don't want to get COVID if you're in Iraq. You know,
you die.
Yeah, you die, and the hospitals are a nightmare, and people trying to steal your oxygen tank, and it's an ugly, ugly situation there. In fact, I was just trying to help somebody whose mother was trying to be helped to get from one hospital to another, and we succeeded in doing that, but she still died, and it's tough there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So again, power shift. There's a lot of talk about repositioning military to Southeast Asia and the China front. What do you see along that line?
Yeah, well, hopefully we won't get into a military confrontation with China over Taiwan or anything else, because nobody needs or wants that. You know, China has been behaving more aggressively and belligerently than they used to, which may be a sign that things aren't so great in China economically or otherwise. I don't really, all this bluster on their part may be a sign of weakness, but they're obviously one of our top threats, not militarily so much, but economically. And
well, they've done a great job with their Belt and Road embedding throughout South America and Africa, doing dams and roads. And
yeah, as America has pulled back, you know, kind of starting with Obama and then certainly with Trump. And like I said, even now Biden appears to be pulling back. As we pull back, China is happy to move in and gain influence. Now, they don't always succeed. You know, there's a lot of times there's a lot of resentment, or they end up owing the Chinese a lot of money. But they're doing their best to be, you know, a or the world leader in the future.
Mm-hmm. But intrinsic in that was one of the sub-themes of part of the Vietnam era, and that had to do with hearts and minds.
Right.
Talk to us about that for a moment.
Again, and this is not my area of expertise, but...
But you watched that unfold over the last year, over your lifetime.
And that's the thing that just gets back to the limits on American power projection. You know, there's only so much we can do, and we need to be smart about how we do it. You know, there are probably ways to win hearts and minds over, but it seems like we rarely see it through. We rarely do it the right way. You know, you send somebody overseas, and after 6 months or a year at most, after they've finally learned the job, they're pulled out, and the next guy comes in. And you know, as the Afghans are learning the hard way, you trust America and our promises at your peril, because we have done this time and time again. Not because we're bad people, but this is the way that our government and our bureaucracy works. And the bottom line is we betray people. If I were in some country and they said, I'm from the U.S. government, you know, trust me, we'll get you out when the time comes. No thanks.
Yeah. I forgot to mention that you, H.K. Roy, are the author of an awesome book called American Spy.
Well, that book came out 2 years ago, and you were kind enough to have me on your show then to talk about it. It's a nonfiction book. It's a series of vignettes, true stories, running from training all the way up until today and what I've been doing in Iraq.
And you were in Kosovo, right?
Yeah, so I spent up 10 years both PCS and TDY, meaning permanently based and temporary duty, in the Balkans, starting off in Belgrade at the end of the Cold War and the start of their civil war. I was there PCS for 2 years, with my family, and got some denied area, what we call denied area experience, where you're under a lot more surveillance and scrutiny than you would be in a benign area.
And you had an Iranian officer trying to take you out.
Right. So that was in Sarajevo. You know, the war in Bosnia started in about 92, and the U.S. stayed out of it, for better or for worse, for the first 3 years. And by the summer of 95, the Serbs were, you know, it was really a bad situation. The Bosnian Muslims were being slaughtered and starved, and the Clinton administration decided finally they were going to do something about it with NATO to stop this rampage, because they were going to take over Sarajevo as well. We had no CIA station in Sarajevo at the time. And I heard it was Hillary Clinton, who was at the time not Secretary of State, but First Lady, who said the CIA needs to open up a station there so we can collect intelligence, and then NATO will go in and start bombing in the fall. So since I had been serving in the Balkans and I had established an official service-to-service relationship with the Croatian Security Service when they created their new government and country during the war, I was asked to go back and do the same thing with the Bosnian Security Service in the middle of this war. So it was almost impossible just to get into Sarajevo at the time. This was July of 95. But it's a long story, and it's all in the book. But I got in with the help of a couple of special operators from the military. And then again, the U.S. military was not in Bosnia at the time.
Right.
You know, one or two might sneak in or out in civilian clothing and help out a guy like me. But so that's how I got in. And when I got there, again, it was a war zone situation with, you know, mortars and rockets landing night and day, threat of sniper fire. The locals were very hungry because they were practically being cut off of food. They were being starved. And while I was there, the massacre at Srebrenica took place, which is, again, I cover that in the book, but and people who follow the Balkans will know about that. Is that the Serbs essentially kicked out the UN peacekeepers and slaughtered 8,000 men and boys who had been promised safe haven by the UN. And so I reported on that, and initially the U.S. government didn't believe it because, come on, this is Europe in the 90s, and you know, nobody's going to slaughter 8,000 people over the course of 3 days. And of course, it turned out to be completely true. And I was collecting this intelligence in part from the Bosnian Security Service. They had great information, which they were happy to share, because they knew that we were going to then, you know, I would say, you know, where's the communication center? Where's the ammo dump and all that? We'd pinpoint these things, and then NATO would come in and blow them up. So they were happy to share that kind of intelligence. And at the time, there were a lot of these Muj from Afghanistan who had come to Bosnia to help the Bosnian Muslims, because the U.S., they thought, turned its back on the Bosnian Muslims who were being slaughtered. Proof to them and to bin Laden, who also was in Bosnia, that America didn't care about Muslims. And I believe this is one of the reasons, Bosnia is one of the reasons that bin Laden turned on us, in addition to the fact that we were in Mecca in Saudi Arabia. At any rate, I knew there were also some Iranians in Sarajevo, although at that moment in time it wasn't a huge concern. But when I asked the Bosnian Security Service director, who was my counterpart, about it, he said, look, Iran helps us. They're welcome here. End of discussion. And I knew they were helping, because when I was in Croatia, we intercepted a 747 relief flight, so-called relief flight from Iran, which in fact was full of weapons and mercenaries headed to Bosnia. So I knew they were there. My Bosnian counterpart wouldn't talk about it. And I would meet him every day when I was there. One day he called me into this little, like a walk-in room. He was there in his military fatigues, as was this big, I called him an Arab-looking guy, Middle Eastern-looking guy, looked me over, and I said, you know, what's up? And he goes, oh, sorry, HK, I'll meet you upstairs in 15 minutes. Okay. That was weird. You know, I didn't know what was going on, but they were both dressed the same way. And there are some Bosnians who, you know, kind of descended from Turks or whatever. So, you know, there are some Middle Eastern looking Bosnians, although for the most part they're Slavic people and, you know, they don't look like that guy. Anyway, I found out very quickly from an unimpeachable source that the guy that I was showcased to was the head of the Iranian intelligence service in Bosnia. And in fact, I was able to read an English translation of his cable back to Tehran, where he laid out his plan to kidnap, torture, execute me, as they had done with CIA chief William Buckley in Beirut, like 10 years before that. Mm-hmm. Hezbollah, controlled by Iran, did that. And if the Iranians get you, they will never let you go. They won't trade you the way others will for money or for whatever, for other prisoners.
Mm-hmm. You're done.
If you're caught, you're done.
Yeah.
And so I fortunately found out about this threat and this plan, and then talked with, you know, with my headquarters and with UCOM in Stuttgart, and figured out. I said, you know, we decided I needed to get out because I was the only guy there. We had no U.S. forces there. Mm-hmm. You know, there was me and a couple of security guys in our official office there, and so to make a long story short, which may be too late now, a couple of the security guys, including one undercover, let's just call him a special forces guy who was there, we went out in the middle of the night over Mount Igman, which is how you got in and out of Sarajevo in those days. It was a very deadly road because the threat generally was from the Serbs, who would, they would actually fire anti-aircraft guns at vehicles on this road. So you'd always go in and out at night, mm-hmm. lights out, you know, the night vision goggles, and hope you didn't get shot by the Serbs. But now, in addition to that threat, I had to worry about the Iranians and their, I found out, their Bosnian collaborators, the guys who I thought were, you know, my partners, mm-hmm. were actually cooperating with the Iranian intelligence service to get me. And
wow.
So you can, it's, the story's in the first chapter of mm-hmm. the book, but obviously I made it out.
Yeah. So once again, the book, American Spy, available Amazon or
Amazon
anywhere.
And everywhere else.
So just look for H.K. Roy plus American Spy.
And not all the stories are that
dramatic.
Dramatic. There are lots of funny stories in there as well. And a lot of it was written with young people in mind, like if they want to join the CIA, what's it like? What's mm-hmm. the training like? What do you have to do?
Yeah.
So hopefully it will appeal to a lot of people, and it's hopefully entertaining as well. Lots of humor.
Very cool. H.K., thanks for spending the morning with me.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank
this
you for having
great.
Me.
You're welcome. We've been speaking with H.K. Roy, former CIA agent. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter, down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives. and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station. Laila hai bewafa rakhti hai space mein kar di ishq kam azmat da.